Welcome to the Stand Tall podcast, brought to you by Women in Property. I am Rachel Bell, National Chair for Women in Property and Director at Stride Glam, an architectural practice and certified B Corporation. Stand Tall is my mantra. It's served me well when I've had to step into a new situation or face up to a fear. Stand Tall has reminded me I can do it. And it's not just something I can do. Stand Tall is about supporting and encouraging others to step outside of their comfort zone and try something which they may have feared doing. The Women in Property Network is an incredible community and a meaningful space to share experiences. And I hope this podcast provides some insights into how others who are trailblazing and standing tall in their own way have got to that point. So today's guest for the second Stand Tall podcast is Priya Shah, and perhaps setting a bit of a trend for another trailblazer in the industry from Harrow. So for those listeners that just joining us who haven't checked out the first Stand Tall podcast, that was with Alice Lamb of Land Aid, who was also or had connections to Harrow. So welcome, Priya. I'm going to hand over to you to introduce yourself. So if you can just tell us a little bit about you and your current roles, and then we'll start our discussions.
Sure. Thanks, Rachel. Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast. Really great to be here. And yeah, really enjoyed the first podcast with Alice. Love the shout out to Harrow. And yeah, representing Harrow very proudly today as well. So I am founder of BAME and Property, which is an organisation to promote more ethnic diversity in the property and planning sectors. It's about 3.5 years old. It started off as a networking organisation, and certainly pre-COVID, we had an array of networking events with the likes of Savills to Cushman & Wakefield, Landsec, K&L Gates, some really nice, well-attended events. And then during COVID, we started evolving to offer more strategic advice to the property and planning sectors, lunch and learns, and you know, supporting media campaigns and things like that. We still do events, and hopefully we'll be holding one when things get better as well post-COVID. I'm also an engagement consultant at Grayling. So my work is based around community engagement, stakeholder engagement, supporting planning applications, really going out into, you know, inner cities, towns, and so on, and getting into the, you know, ground of what people actually want with developments, ensuring that it's diverse, it's inclusive. So it really comes hand in hand with my role and my work with BAME and Property.
Brilliant. Thanks, Priya. And as I say, really great to have this discussion. I've been looking forward to it for quite some time. See you on various different platforms, and obviously a very big advocate for social media. So yeah, it feels like sometimes I'm stalking you and maybe you stalking me as well. So you forgot to mention your absolutely amazing accolade as well in terms of being named as RTPI Women of Influence in sort of 2018, to your Estates Gazette Rising Stars in 2018 as well, to like a Property Week Trailblazer in 2019. And then most recently, I believe you were named one of three women in Grayling who were shortlisted for the PR Week 30 Under 30. And yeah, quite amazing for someone still so young to have such an accolade of achievement. So yeah, well done. And I hope there's maybe more that we've missed off the list there. So
I think that's quite enough, but thank you. Yeah, it's probably too many now.
No, absolutely. It's a really good testament to lots of hard work. I want to take the opportunity to illustrate really how people get to where they get to through this podcast, and just sort of look to how they've sort of taken decisions and reached, you know, where they've got to. And I know you in previous articles have sort of written about the career as a journey, and it's not a race, and actually reminding yourself to stop competing and start enjoying what you're doing. So I wondered if that's quite a good place to start, and just to illustrate really your journey to where you've got to. So I don't know whether that's a bit about certainly your childhood. We've just talked about your childhood room that you're still sat in and your childhood house, but now moving on to exciting things with your own home. So I wondered if you wouldn't mind sort of just talking us through some of the steps, and maybe we can just sort of illustrate some of those key decisions of how you've got to really where you've got to now.
Sure, yeah. So yeah, born and bred in Harrow, went to school here. So went to a comprehensive school, and then I went to a grammar school for my A-levels in Watford. So yeah, still pretty decent there. Obviously something which was instilled in me and my siblings from a really young age was just working really hard, making sure that we went to university. My parents, both immigrants, they came from East Africa and India, and for them they didn't have the opportunity to go to university. So for us, we're first generation university educated within our own family, certainly the same amongst our extended family, cousins and so on as well. So for us, it was a real milestone for us to go to university, to work really hard. So I went to Warwick University. I studied politics and international studies, much to my parents' disappointment. They wanted me to become a pharmacist or a doctor or an accountant. Certainly they pushed me towards doing work experience at an accounting firm. All of my cousins and I did the same 2-week work experience at one of my uncle's firms. And some people loved it and continued to go on to do graduate schemes at KPMG and EY and so on. For me, I hated it, and that confirmed it for me at that age. At the age of 16, I never looked at accounting and finance again. I wish I did. It's really helpful to understand accountancy and just taxes and, you know, really boring things like that. But that for me was just a useful thing to actually just do and to just confirm that for myself. I've always been more interested in the humanities and the social sciences. So at school, I was always naturally drawn to human geography, history. And then for my A-levels, I took economics and politics and just like focused on human geography as well. Absolutely loved it, which is why I went on to do politics and international relations at Warwick. And again, really enjoyed my time there. Then after university, I actually landed my dream job with my summer internship working at the Department for International Development. Again, really fortunate to get an internship there. I know how difficult it is, especially in that department. Everyone wants to go to DFID or the Foreign Office. But I was on their summer diversity internship program, which is actually aimed at those from, you know, more socially disadvantaged backgrounds or ethnic diversity backgrounds. So for me, you know, being from my background clearly worked in my favour at that point in my life. And I worked in the Syria crisis unit for 3 months, and it was absolutely incredible. You know, worked right at the heart of the Syria crisis, which sadly is still going on. But it was really amazing. And then from then on, I went and did another internship at a think tank, which focused on Middle East and North African politics and relations. So again, really, really interesting. I think the struggle, or the challenge that I found was just trying to find a job which would actually pay me. I think internships are great, but this particular internship, not the DFID one, but the think tank one, was unpaid. And at the age of 21, I was just eager to start earning money, you know, just to have my own responsibilities and to just start enjoying myself at that age. So I started looking for graduate schemes, and I came across one with a comms agency, which had lots of different areas to travel, consumer PR, everything. And also a political stream and a planning and engagement one. I didn't really know what it was, but I thought that was most suited to my skill set and my degree. So I applied for it, got it. And I guess I kind of just fell into planning and engagement and working in property. And so, yeah, I've just been working in that field ever since. I've been working on, you know, planning applications, small, large infrastructure applications ever since. I've worked at a few agencies now, BECG. I spent a few years at, which was great. Really enjoyed my time there. Then I took a sabbatical. So I decided to quit my job. I've always wanted to go traveling. I've absolutely loved it. From the age of about 24, 25, I started doing solo trips. And the first solo trip I did was to India. I did the Golden Triangle. It was one of those organized tours. I did a G-Adventure. So it's still not entirely on your own, but I was on my own in the sense that I didn't have any friends or family with me. I made friends on the trip, people that I still talk to today. And what we had in common was our shared interest and love for travel. And it was amazing. I absolutely loved it. And I've never looked back. So I then did a few more of those solo trips. I went to Vietnam. I went to a few places in Africa, and that's where my love for Africa started. So I went to South Africa, And since then, I've been three more times. I went to Namibia, which, I mean, who goes to Namibia? And it was absolutely amazing. I went to Sisuflay, which is the desert, which you will see in books and in films and all those lovely photography shows and so on. I went to Zambia and Zimbabwe. I saw Victoria Falls on both sides. It was absolutely incredible, an ultimate dream of mine. And that's why, for me, quitting my job at the age of 25, some may call it a quarter-life crisis, I saw it as an opportunity, was the perfect moment to just go off and do some more exploring. Certainly living at home helped, didn't have any other, you know, financial responsibilities such as paying rent, which meant that I was in a financial position to do it. I know lots of other people aren't so fortunate and able to do that, but I count my blessings in that sense that I was able to do that. I'd worked hard for the first 4 years after graduating to, you know, get to that stage. And so I was ready to do that. BECG very kindly said I could even come back afterwards. So, you know, there was always that potential job security there. So I just went, didn't look back. And I've never looked back. I spent 2 months traveling around Southern Africa. So I went to South Africa for 5 weeks where I did a research project. I went to the University of KwaZulu-Natal, went to the Gandhi Luthuli Documentation Centre where I undertook research in Durban, looking at the housing struggles that the Indian population have faced there since 1952 when the Group Areas Act came into place in South Africa. So just looking at how apartheid affected the different ethnic groups. And it was fascinating. I took all my skills from stakeholder engagement and applied them to my research. I did undertook interviews with political stakeholders. I went to do community engagement. I spoke to the head of a resident association. I got to speak to Mahatma Gandhi's granddaughter. She's an incredible woman, truly remarkable, if I may say so. Just full of wisdom. She gave me a private tour of one of the townships over there. I met such incredible people. I've made lifelong friends. I even went to Zanzibar and Tanzania as well. I did a safari in the Serengeti. I'm actually forgetting this landlocked country that I went to just beside South Africa. It's Lesotho. I went to Lesotho as well. So just like went into a land, just popped to Lesotho for a day. So yeah, ticked off another country which no one ever goes to. So literally had the most amazing time.
And I hear that you're now focusing or doing some part-time studies on sort of African city development. And is that kind of from the love of traveling over there and,
yeah,
and being absorbed? I mean, you're talking to someone who absolutely loves traveling and has fallen in love with certain countries, Malawi being one, through the traveling that I've done over there and supporting women and schools and that there. So presumably once you had your excitement of traveling, you came back and had to find work again here.
I just came back from my travels and spent a few months just growing Bayman Property. Actually, I developed a website, something which I didn't really have for it. So I learned how to code and do all these little things, which, you know, I didn't really know what to do. I did a bit of freelance work in the comm sector. I went and met loads of stakeholders across the property and planning sectors, just understanding what do they want out of Bayman Property. Do they want recruitment support? Do they want a membership model? Just going out there doing my market research. So every week I would, you know, have a few meetings in London. I'd coffee around. I actually had a really great time. But of course it was time to return to work because there is only so many months you can go without, you know, working. But I learned so many skills, not just from my travels, but just from all of the work that I was doing in growing and developing Bayman Property. Those interpersonal skills, those communication skills, they've never really left me. I am a comms consultant through and through, and it's what's guided me and helped me grow Bayman Property, just through our social media presence, for example, through the public speaking that I do, through my media presence. It's all comms, ultimately. It's how you communicate with people and get them to grow with you. And that's how I came across Grayling. I knew it was a great agency in the communication sector. And that's why, I've been there ever since. So it's been nearly 2 years at Grayling. I work in their Engage practice, working on large infrastructure projects and doing planning and development as well.
Excellent, excellent. And from that, in terms of, you know, the startup of Bayman Property and recognising that there was a need for a focus on developing that as an initiative, from you really kind of taking hold of that, What challenges did you initially sort of find and face in terms of trying to start up something that was absent in the industry and recognizing that there was something that was really needed there? What sort of challenges did you personally sort of face on really saying, look, you know, come on, everyone, this is, you know, this is needed?
Yeah, I think when I started Bayman Property in, well, I guess December 2017, but really early 2018, in advance of my first event, the real struggle was trying to get sponsorship. So a lot of people were talking about the need for ethnic diversity, saying, yeah, we know it exists. But when I said, okay, well, put your money where your mouth is and help sponsor my first event, a lot of them turned me down. In fact, nearly all of them turned me down. And in the end, BECG, you know, put most of the money towards our launch event. So I'm, you know, hugely grateful to BECG for all of the support that they gave me in growing Bayman Property in its early days. So there's another shout out for them. But yeah, I think that was really challenging, just getting people to understand the need for this. I mean, I identified that need whilst working in the industry, because it wasn't just, you know, amongst my colleagues or in my project teams or with the clients that I was working with, but going to networking events in particular, you know, they weren't very diverse in their attendance or on their panels. I mean, there was one event that I went to which just had four white men on the panel. I mean, at least have some women. I just couldn't quite believe it. And this was as early as, you know, 2017, so not even that long ago. And you know, even just that kind of tacit discrimination or those comments that people made. I got called an Indian princess in one of my meetings. I could, you know, taken out of context, you actually think what? And whatever the context, though, no one should be saying things like that. Even my own friends don't call me that. So it was just completely out of order. And so it was a culmination of things to get to that point. People knew it was around and it existed, but I think the problem with setting up an organization like Bayman Property or anything to do with race is that is it. You're talking about race, you're talking about racism, potentially discrimination. It's a really sensitive issue. People still struggle to even say black. There's a black woman over there. And they'll describe every feature about them without actually saying that they're a black woman or a black individual. And I think that's part of the problem, is that if you can't get over that fear of talking about something, it then becomes very difficult to actually make that progress and to make that change. So I think that's been the second issue, is trying to bring companies on that journey with me, because they genuinely believe and they want to make that change. I think it's one thing actually just saying it, but it's another thing doing. So I think, you know, there are certainly companies out there which are making those changes. You know, they've committed to ethnicity pay gap reporting, for example. They've started diversifying their recruitment processing, all these sort of things that they've been doing. But there's a lot of companies which will happily just release PR statements out there, certainly during Black Lives Matter. You know, I was completely inundated with emails, you know, with companies asking for advice and support. You know, but do they even ask their Black colleagues, how are you doing? Are you okay? How's your mental health? Probably not. And they, yeah, they've released their Blackout Tuesday images, you know, nearly a year ago now, actually over a year ago now. And, you know, without actually thinking, how is my public image? You know, what am I actually doing internally to make a difference? And I think that is part of the problem, is that companies want to show that they're doing something, but making that change is a long-term change. It's not going to happen overnight. So just releasing a statement doesn't mean that you've done something.
I think that there is a long way to go. It's the pipeline, isn't it? It's coming up through. It's been able to have those processes in place, reach out much more widely. We're having discussions about work experience at the moment. And of course, you'll be inundated with emails from friends and family saying, please. And we're not necessarily pushing back on that, because we want to help them too, but ensuring that actually we're reaching out to those in need that don't have those connections. And I think that really goes more widely across the diversity piece more widely. So you touched on maybe some challenging discussions there about the Indian princess or assumptions. How have you kind of equipped yourself in dealing with that? I mean, personally, I will worry about things that I should have said this, or, you know, I'm in a situation and I don't respond, and I really kind of chew over that for days after and say, how have you learned to really kind of equip yourself to, and you come across as someone very strong-willed and confident? Have you always been like that, or have you had certain kind of, you know, yeah, how have you kind of helped yourself along the way to deal with maybe some challenging situations like that?
Yeah, I definitely wasn't always not this confident, but as I guess more confident. I mean, when I was called an Indian princess, I didn't say anything. And I wish I had the confidence to say, that's not right. Don't call me an Indian princess. I look back on that moment. I can actually remember it so vividly in my head. And I wish I had said to that person, don't call me that. But it's just one of those things. I was so young at the time. I was only 24. I was only a senior account executive. I had no authority at all. And I think what was worse was that the people in the room didn't say anything either. And that didn't give me the confidence. So I think, you know, looking back on it, maybe I didn't know any better, or maybe I wasn't in a position to say anything. But certainly today, if anyone said anything out of line, I absolutely would stamp them down.
I mean, imagine.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's just one of those things which has just grown over time. Certainly speaking at a lot of public events has grown my confidence. I remember speaking at my first event, how nervous I was. I even like wrote some notes and prepared a speech. Now I don't write any notes. I just speak off the cuff. It's just one of those things that I would much rather sound more natural, which is why I'd never sound, you know, perfect. And I think that just, I guess that's what people want to hear. Something else, which I don't really talk about often. I used to have a stutter. And one of the things that I did was actually drama at school. So I loved it. That gave me a lot of confidence. And then over time, again, more public speaking. I did the Rotary public speaking competitions. And obviously having Indian parents, they didn't really know that I had a stutter. They were just like, why can't you speak properly? And I didn't know I had a stutter either. It was so, actually thinking about it now, it's actually quite sad. Like none of us knew what I had, what was wrong with me. And then I just Googled it. And that's when I understood I had a stutter. And even now I still have it. I just control it. I just know how to control it. It's all about having that confidence. If you're confident with what you're saying and you're saying it with conviction, it's much easier to control it. But certainly there are many times when I'm so nervous and I can't get the words out. And that is when it really, really affects me. And it's such a vicious cycle. You know, it's there and then you worry about it and then it affects you anyway. And then, it's horrible. But you know, I think it's one of those things which I have learned to control. And most people do say to me, oh, I've never thought you've got a stutter. But, you know, it's just one of those things that public speaking really does help. You know, if you're given that opportunity to speak, do it. I mean, I get asked to speak at events all the time. And I'll be honest, I do turn down a lot of events these days, not just because I'm busy, but because, you know, it's time to pass the baton. You know, there are lots of people out there who've got really interesting things to say. And I think people have heard me, you know, bark about the same things quite a lot. And, you know, I'm sure I've got new things to say as well. But it's really important to give that opportunity to other people as well. And I think, you know, for me, certainly, having confidence is having the confidence to say no. And being able to say no, that is a really, really important skill. Actually saying, you know what, this is not for me. I'm going to pass this opportunity on to someone else. Or I'm sorry, but I don't have that time. I actually just want to focus on my mental health, or I want to have some personal time. I've got plans. I don't want to spend my weekend prepping a speech or just something like that. And actually saying no is just as important as saying yes and having that confidence to say yes.
There is a lot there that I'd like to discuss much further. And I wonder if we talk about that now or come back to that in a bit. I'm quite interested in terms of where you think Bayman Property is kind of heading, really, because you have seen that evolution in a very, very short time since 2017, sort of forming, you know, the networking, being able to kind of give people that support network, to now sort of really being a touch point of intelligence and you know, supporting organizations. Are you seeing it kind of evolve into something more? I just wonder what maybe your future plans are on that, if you have any. I mean, it's hard enough sometimes seeing week to week at the moment. We can talk about COVID and how you've dealt with that in a bit as well. So yeah, there's lots of things that I'd like to come back on, but yeah, that especially.
Yeah, I think certainly this year, I think it's navigating through COVID, still doing what we're doing in providing that strategic support to companies. In January, we launched a job board, actually. So I spent a couple of months just speaking to a number of companies at the end of last year, just asking them and just understanding, what do you want out of a job board? Like, how would you like it to operate? Would you want people to create their own account on the Bayman Property website? Keeping in mind for myself, that's a lot of work. Or would you rather it was just a hosting platform? And actually, all of the companies that I spoke to came back to me and said they just wanted to be a hosting platform. Ultimately, they want anyone who looks at a job posting to end up on their website. Why would they want people to hover and just stay on my website? That's kind of not the point. So since January, we've you know, launched a job board, and every week there's several postings, you know, sometimes up to five or six, you know, with a range of companies, organizations, small and big, all across the industry, all at different levels as well. So from graduate to director level, and it's been going really well. So with that, again, using my comm skills to do some social media marketing as well. So that's been great. And I think that's going really, really well. Certainly just seeing the evolution of that, how I can make that into a bit more of a, I guess, credit system for companies, certainly the larger ones who know that they're going to have multiple job offerings in a year, creating a bit more of a package for them, maybe offering them some advice with that package as well. And then yeah, later on in the year, assuming, you know, restrictions are lifting or all lifted as well, I'd really like to hold an in-person event with our charity partners. So we've got two charity partners, LandAid, so a little shout out to them, and Binti Period, which I'm also an ambassador for. And yeah, we would have loved to have held a charity event last year in 2019. Actually, our charity partner was DKMS. So we partnered with Knight Frank and we did an event about the importance of stem cell donations within BAME communities. And it was a really lovely event. We had DKMS present at the event. We had 35 people sign up to the to the stem cell register on the night. We had a speech from this was from myself, but it was on behalf of a 6-year-old girl who sadly died from leukemia. Her mom had written a speech and she asked me to read it. It was a bittersweet evening because it was beautiful but really emotional at the same time, and it was around Diwali time, so for me that would be the ideal time to hold a charity event for both our partners, LandAid and Binti Period. Really bring the industry together, celebrate this, you know, lovely event, and just bring people together. So that's what I'm looking forward to doing this year.
And again, lots of things we can pick up there in terms of explaining a bit more about what Binti Period is about, which I know, you know, again, following you is a massive, big vocal platform that you have there, and raising awareness for, you know, female menstruation and that. So, yeah, let's touch upon that. But also I'm quite interested in terms of how someone who is very much connected to people and, you know, very good networking, etc., has managed through COVID and managed through the lockdowns. People have asked me, you know, exactly the same sort of, how have you coped, thinking that I would have really struggled, and actually I've quite enjoyed it, in terms of just that real sort of game changer, drawing a line, and actually having an opportunity to spend time at home, not have a break, because it's been full on in terms of online meetings, but actually just, yeah, change the dynamics a little bit. And I've really welcomed that. And I'm holding on to as much as I can as we're now coming through the other side. I just wondered from your side, how you found it, surrounded by family yourself anyway, but has that been what you kind of expected? How have you dealt with that yourself? So
I personally have loved working from home. I think before COVID, we literally had to have a doctor's appointment in the middle of the day to be able to work from home. It was never something that you could just do. It really, really had to have a legitimate reason to do so. And now, you know, you think, why would I go into the office to just send emails all day? You know, it's ridiculous. So for me, I've loved working from home. It's cut the commute. I used to spend 2.5 hours a day commuting into London. So I live on the suburbs of London. And that, you know, that drained me in itself. It was physically and mentally draining. So I've got that time back. I've done so much more exercising. I've explored my local area, discovered a stunning nature reserve that I've had literally my whole life on my doorstep. And it literally is next door to me. And I've really enjoyed going out and about, you know, exploring on these nature trails, taking my photos as well. So I go to the gym every morning now. So don't commute, go to the gym. And it's amazing. It's done wonders just for my health and my mental health. And I'm still getting my work done. And I just don't know why we've not been doing this all the time. There is still a need for the office. I think, you know, there is a crucial role for, especially for the creative industries, which I work in, like PR. Like, I think teamwork and that being in a collaborative forum is really important. So that will never go away. But you just don't need to be in the office every day. And I think we need to move away from that. You've got to be in the office to show that you're present and that you're working, because clearly we've been able to show and achieve so much during this, during all of the lockdown periods. Yeah. That, you know, the future is hybrid. And just to confirm, it's not the office, it's the commute that's the problem. You know, and I think that is literally the same for everyone. And I think if you know, that's why co-working spaces and the whole 15-minute city models are really, really important, because they allow you to work close to where you live without working from home.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, let's drop back to explain a little bit more about your role and what you're trying to raise awareness for through the association with Binti period, because I think that's really valued for the listeners to hear a bit more about.
Sure. So yeah, Binti Period is a charity which looks to end period poverty in the UK and also around the world, but mainly in the UK. And yeah, it's really about not just ending poverty, but changing the narrative around periods, changing that stigma, or rather removing that stigma around periods, and just, you know, bringing it into everyday conversation. So it's a charity that I've been following for a while. And a couple of years ago, I approached the founder, Manjit Gill, and I said, look, how do I become an ambassador? I really want to support your work even more. I felt like at that point I was quite influential in the property industry, and I said, look, I want to use my influence in the property industry to talk about good design, access to toilets, diversity in design, to make sure that we are, as an industry which is hugely influential just in society, are providing, you know, the right toilets, the right space for toilets, not just always providing gender neutral toilets, because understanding that when a woman or a girl is on her period, they may want that privacy, they may want their own, you know, gender specific toilets, you know, often providing more toilets for certain genders, because as we all know, women take longer in the toilet, there's always a massive queue outside toilets. You know, why is it equal? Just because it's equal doesn't mean that it's fair. And so I think, you know, it's just about making sure that I'm using my voice in a way that is creating some positive change. So it's, you know, it's firstly about that, and having, you know, diversity in design teams, because it's about ensuring that people are culturally aware about why we might need to have gender specific toilets, you know, why, you know, for some cultures, you know, such as South Asian cultures, they don't want to use gender neutral toilets and be in that space with a male while they're on their period, or at all. Depends. I still don't feel comfortable going into gender neutral toilets. I completely appreciate and understand that it's very progressive, but sometimes you go into public buildings where they only provide unisex toilets, and I do question that, because I don't think that's the right thing to do. I think a good design has, you know, female toilets, male toilets, gender neutral toilets, disabled toilets, family toilets, everything. And yes, it's a lot of toilets to provide, but that is what diversity and inclusion is. So I think, you know, for me, that's really what it's about. It's using my voice and my influence to talk about the importance of that. And then from a personal perspective, it's really about smashing the shame about periods and just making it a really normal part of conversation. So not calling it sanitary or sanitation. Sanitation is a Dettol wipe. Let's call it, you know, periods, period products. That's what it is. Let's not beat around the bush. You know, it's half the population have periods. Let's just talk about it. And I'm talking about it a lot. And I'll stop now, period. So, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. So, I mean, even just going through that, you cover a huge amount, Priya. How do you switch off? Now, you've mentioned, obviously, during lockdown, you've been going to the gym and things. You've mentioned as well the travel. And I think I read somewhere that, you know, there's nothing more than you like exploring a new country and going off and doing lots of walking. Certainly, that would be my choice as well. But you were kind of alluding to what I talk about quite a lot about saying no to things, because it's great saying yes, and the fact that you want to sort of help everyone and get involved in everything, but at some point you're going to have to say no, and you can't do it all. How have you kind of learned to say no, and how has that made you feel in terms of, you know, the fear of missing out almost because you're not saying yes? Yeah, how have you tackled that, and are there any lessons there for people, because I'm sure there are many of us around?
Yeah, certainly in the beginning, I would say yes to everything because I wanted the opportunities, I wanted the exposure. And I didn't want to miss out. I just thought, you know, what if they find someone else when here I am, I've set up this network, I am a good person to have on your panel, for example. So yeah, certainly in the beginning, I was saying yes. Then when my name got out there a little bit more, it was much easier to say no, or I would just say, look, I can't do it, but I'll put someone forward for my network, for example. So that was, you know, that was really important, you know, passing on that opportunity. I think when you're saying no, but you're suggesting someone else, you're actually doing a really kind thing. You're actually, you know, passing on that opportunity to someone who may have not had that opportunity otherwise, who may not know, or who may not have the confidence to say yes. And I think that is a really, really important thing, is that when you're saying no, you're protecting your energy. That's what it was about for me. It was, you know, actually being able to say no and say, look, I don't have the mental time or the mental capacity to be able to do this, to be able to do this gig. And actually, you know, I'd rather just watch TV, for example. I know that that sounds terrible. Everyone wants to do that in the evening. I don't want to spend my evening, you know, prepping for another event. And which is why most of the time for, you know, events, I'm able to just speak off the cuff now, because I've actually had that mental capacity to go out and do something different to me, you know, read a book, for example, which has expanded my knowledge in something completely different. And I think that is really, really important. So it's not something which came naturally to me. It's something which develops over time. And certainly when, you know, when you've grown your profile in an industry, it's much easier to say no to things. But one of the things that I would say to people is just remember that when you're saying no, you're doing it for yourself. You know, it's you don't have to say yes to everything. It's so important to look after yourself, to look after number one, which is yourself first. And that is what I would say is, if you don't have the time, you don't have the mental capacity, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to say yes. And people understand. People are like, okay, look, thank you for letting me know. But if you go and just say, oh, I might be able to do it, or you take a really long time to respond, you're actually not doing them a favor either. You're just, you know, they're waiting for you to confirm or to say maybe, and they haven't been able to find someone else. Whereas if you just say no in the first instance, because you know you can't do it, you know you don't want to do it, you're letting them have that capacity to go and find someone else. So actually do everyone a favor. And if you don't want to do it, say no. And if you're struggling to say no, come speak to me.
Absolutely. And yeah, there are certainly, if you know, through Women in Property, lots of different organizations that if people are struggling for speakers on the whole, there are lots of avenues then to approach and be able to. And yeah, fully support everything that you just said there. I think I was told, remember that as soon as you say no, you're saying yes to something else, and that yes might be an opportunity to go and do something for yourself. So yeah, with you all the way on that one. In terms of, I just wondered from your side, if there were any particular role models that have helped you through, you know, your journey so far, and certainly kind of maybe related more to your industry position and job roles, or even through sort of the startup of Bayman Property. Has there been a role model there for you along the way?
Yeah, so someone that I really look up to is Charlotte Morford, who is the co-founder of Women in Planning. And she's someone that I spoke to before I started up Bayman Property. And even all throughout this time, she's been a really good sounding board. And we often have chats, you know, just on various platforms. And she's amazing. I mean, we all know how incredible Charlotte is. I don't know how she finds the capacity to do everything that she does. But she's been a really, really amazing person to speak to just get some tips, to just learn from. And I guess, you know, just bounce ideas off each other. And I think, you know, she's someone that I really look up to and I find really inspiring. So she's been great. And just many other people who've gone out of their way to, you know, set up organizations in the industry as well. Ultimately, we're all doing the same thing in terms of putting our time towards something else which isn't our main job. And it's you look at all of these founders and you can empathize with them, literally, because we're all in a very similar position, just like yourself, Rachel. I find you really inspiring because you're like me. You've got this really important role as chair of Women in Property, and you've also got a full-time job as an architect. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, you know, we wear multiple hats. And it's not always possible to answer or to respond to someone immediately, but we will get around to it. And I think, you know, that's just one of those things that sometimes we really understand each other in that sense, don't we?
Absolutely. And Charlotte's a great shout out. Again, someone who I feel as though I know very, very well through sort of social media, and yeah, hear lots about her. So that's a really good person to have as a role model. I think we're probably coming to the end of our discussion, but I just wondered if there was anything more from just your career and looking forward. And I mean, we mentioned about the additional studies that you're doing on urban development in Africa, and if there was anything there that you're particularly focusing on, and yeah, where you may go next in terms of just the direction on a career. So
yeah, so that particular course, looking at planning and development in African cities, was a FutureLearn course. And FutureLearn was something that I discovered during COVID, because I had all of this additional time. I wasn't commuting anymore. So I decided to just find something else to do. And I've always wanted to do something planning related and find it really interesting, but also related to development and, you know, kind of human geography, that angle which I spoke about earlier. And that's when I just stumbled upon FutureLearn. And I know it's very similar to things like Coursera as well, or an Open University course. And I read about it and I thought, this is, you know, really simple way for me to just get a little bit of a flavor of planning and development in Africa without doing a full MSc at UCL. So this is a UCL based course. It's also with the Jolly University in Sierra Leone, and it was done over 4 weeks, and it was absolutely incredible. It was so interesting. I really, really like loved that opportunity to just go back to learning and being on the other side. And you know, you spend my weekends, even my evenings, just reading up on all of the course material, really, really actually doing the reading as opposed to just ticking it on the website, or just saying that I've done it. But I actually did it. And at the end, I had to write an essay to actually pass the course. And again, I really enjoyed that. So yeah, all in all, it was a really fascinating course. And then I actually have since then done another Future Learn course. I think looking at cultural heritage in towns and cities. I did that with the European Institute University, which again was really fascinating. I would recommend both of them. And there's loads of really interesting courses on Future Learn, even on, you know, Coursera as well. But for me, they're a really nice way to just break up my, you know, life, because I'm always going to be doing my job and BAME and property and just everything else. But this is really nice. And I think one of the things I would say is just never stop learning, because it's so important to just expand your knowledge and to explore interests outside of your work on a daily basis. So for me, this was just something that I knew that I had maybe a tacit interest in, but actually reading about the course, I found myself nodding away to a lot of what I was reading. And it was just fascinating. And I was able to have, you know, really interesting conversations with people where I was sharing some of the snippets of information about it from, you know, architecture and colonialism and how this influenced, you know, things in Kenya. So like in Kenya, for example, they have their own town and country planning act influenced by the UK because the British was in Kenya, and it's their planning model. It was actually built on our town and country planning act.
And are you now planning, once we see outside of the pandemic, are you planning a trip? What would be your next trip? And has that been influenced by, you know, some of that learning and understanding about, you know, those places and seeing? Or yeah, I don't wondered what your plans would be.
I mean, oh my god,
in a dream scenario, where
in a dream scenario, my next trip would be South Africa, because I absolutely love the country. I wanted a little go back to all of the vineyards that I've spent so much time. I go back to Durban where I did my research, go visit all the people that, you know, that I've kept in touch with. I love South Africa. It will always have a place in my heart. It's one of those countries that I'm going to keep visiting time and time again. And then, yeah, just outside of South Africa, other parts of Africa as well. But I think we're in one of those situations where, because of COVID, we're all going at different rates. You know, until the whole world is vaccinated, no one is safe. And that's why it's so important that we don't think just about ourselves and just about our own country. We might be lifting our restrictions, but at the back of my mind, I'm always thinking about the countries which are not. I've got family in India, for example, and we all know what's going on in India right now. It's really heartbreaking. And that's why you can never really enjoy yourself until the whole world is at peace. And, you know, we can all be in a situation where we are not, you know, where we are nearly COVID-free. That's when we can really enjoy ourselves.
Absolutely. And yeah, I've been helping a lot of the ladies in Malawi and obviously getting firsthand experience of how they're dealing with it there. So yeah, absolutely with you on that. So I think we're going to have to start drawing this to a close. And here is my quick fire round of questions that everyone will be asked on the Stand Tall podcast. So my mantra is stand tall. And I was wondering if you had a mantra, and if you don't, what would that be if you did have one?
So I think I mentioned it earlier, never stop learning, because, yeah, it's so important to just expand on your knowledge. You know, you will only gain something from expanding your knowledge. So, yeah, never stop learning.
Nice one. And absolutely, that can apply to anyone of any age as well. So that's a good one. And I started this year with one word, and that word is courage. And that was instead of choosing lots of New Year's resolutions. And I wondered if you had one word that was a guiding word for the year. And obviously, we're halfway through, but for the rest of the year, what would that be?
Transformative. So be transformative as opposed to performative. So I know there's a few words there, but the operative word is transformative. You know, just think about what you're doing. It goes back to a lot of what I said about saying no when you need to, saying yes to the right opportunities, and being transformative in that sense.
Nice. And good to challenge that. And then finally, if there would be one thing that you could change about the industry, society, the world, with a magic wand, what would that be?
Well, the world's a bit ambitious, but I mean, obviously for the industry, it would be the lack of diversity. Duh. So yeah, I mean, I'm really trying, and I think we're all doing our little bit with the various groups and organisations that we've started. And I think companies are coming on that journey with us. We've still got a long way to go, but we're going in the right direction.
Amazing. Priya, thanks very much for your time today. Just before we finish, are you able to signpost people to where they can find you on social media, various other platforms?
So BAME in Property Twitter is at BAME in Prop. If you want to follow me and my ramblings and obviously my great words of wisdom, then it's Priya Lala 93, I think, or just search Priya Shah, BAME in Prop. I'm sure you'll find me. On Instagram, we're BAME in Property, or on LinkedIn, we're BAME in Property. So yeah, do give us a follow.
Brilliant. Thanks, Priya. Look out for future episodes, and thanks to BECG and Stride Treglown for sponsoring. And if you want any more information on Women in Property or to follow us, check out womeninproperty.org.uk or WIPUK. And myself is Rachel J_Bell, and that's across Twitter and Instagram. Thank you very much.